Are we ready? Okay. All right. The House Committee on Revenue will come to order for February 22nd, 2007. The first order of, on the agenda is a work session on possible bill introduction.
Mr. Chair.
Paul.
Oh.
Representative Butler.
Would you like these done in blanc? Can we do
that's
that?
That's what I'd like to do.
Okay.
Blanc.
I speak French.
Would you give us a short introduction? Thank you.
Definition. All right. Mr. Chair, you have four, five, six, seven House LC drafts. A reminder again that our bill introduction deadline is Monday at 5 o'clock. The first one is 2094, and what it does is creates an Oregon Tax Expenditure Commission. It does have a provision for revenue raising and requirement of a three-fifths majority. So it lists all of the tax or a number of the tax credits that are currently in law and establishes a sunset provision for those. That's LC 2094. LC 2621 is related to corporate minimum taxes. What it does is have a series of blanks, and it's really designed to give you a vehicle to look at the development of a corporate minimum tax and kind of a clean slate. So that's a vehicle for considering actually some of the issues we'll talk about today. The LC 2623 phases out the senior medical subtraction on the Oregon tax code. What it does is set up an income threshold level, I believe, that's begins at 100,000 single and 200,000 joint adjusted gross income, and then it begins a phase out of that medical subtraction. So that's also a three-fifths vote. LC 2624 is just creates an additional rate for the personal income tax of 10% for high income. It's a relating to taxation. LC 2997 is relating to tobacco products. What it does is repeal the 50-cent cap on cigars and restores the 65-cent wholesale price. Treatment of cigars as other tobacco products. LC 3013 was brought to us by the industry. It's relating to moist snuff and establishes, instead of the wholesale price, imposes a flat per ounce tax on moist snuff. Don't ask me what moist snuff is.
I have not partaken.
Okay. And then finally, LC 3335, we just uncovered this. It's just part of trying to go through the tax expenditure report, look at all of the sunsetted tax expenditures, and we looked at the ones that the governor had recommended in his budget. This is one, it's a relatively minor one related to rehabilitated residential property. We just included it because the governor had recommended that it sunset be extended.
All right. What's your pleasure, Representative Butler?
Mr. Chair, I find many of these ideas ones that I cannot support. However, I recognize that this is the proper venue to have these kinds of discussion. In block, I'd like to propose that we submit as committee bills LC 2094, LC 2621, LC 2623, LC 2624, LC 2997, LC 3013, and LC 3335.
Thank you, Representative Butler. Representative Butler moves that the committee introduces committee bills LC 2094, LC 2621, LC 2623, LC 2624, LC 2997, LC 3013, and LC 3335. Discussion. Seeing none, are there any objections? Seeing none, it is so ordered. Thank you very much. We'll close before we close the work session, let me just say that it is my hope that I can get a quorum for a continuation of our Monday meeting at 4:30 in this room for the purpose of dealing with a continued possible work session on possible bill introductions. We have bill introductions scheduled for Monday, and we'll do that during the regular committee time for what we have. But I am told that the Legislative Council may be dropping bill drafts back to members very, very late, and I thought we could provide that service. So if I can get five members who are willing to be here and be prepared to support bill introductions at 4:30, we'll continue our meeting from the regular time until then.
Mr. Chair, the House Republicans would be delighted to support you.
Thank you. That may take care of that problem.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, sir.
No, never mind. I'll be kind.
In the interest of the administration, the Legislative Council is working very hard to get these things done by the deadline, and they're going to push the limit, I think, and that's the reason for that special continuation of our Monday meeting. Thank you very much, and with that, we will close the work session on possible bill introduction and open an information meeting on business taxation. I understand we have a presentation from our own staff first. Chris?
Mr. Chair, we have an outline for you
of
what we're going to try to do. It's just in your pack, I labeled business taxation, background, and issues. And Chris is actually going to finish up some of the orientation material. We thought this would be a good time to do this for about 10 minutes or so. On how we tax business through the personal income tax. We talked about corporate income tax at length, and this just talks about, Chris will talk about the forms that flow through the personal income tax. The other things that we'll talk about is a little bit about the household business split in Oregon, kind of the history of that issue, and then look at concurrent comparisons. Talk a little bit about some of the problems that have been cited in the corporate income tax. And then about some of the alternatives that have been looked at, in particular Ohio's CAT, which is a commercial activities tax, and I've given you an article on that in your packet that kind of talks about how Ohio arrived at the conclusion they did and their tax reform plan and the experience they've had in the initial phase of it. And then we've asked a business panel where we have Warren Thompson will be here representing AOI, and then Jim Craven and J.L. Wilson. So that'll be our three business panel, give us a perspective from the business side in terms of what kind of taxation issues they see and what they would recommend as the best approach to taxing business.
Thank you. Chris?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Chris Alanak, Legislative Revenue. And as Paul indicated, this is just the last part of the corporate orientation that I did a few weeks ago. So there's just a few slides here. And I think where we left it off, there was some expectation that there might be a little amendment to...
Madison, where are you?
Doing nothing.
Madison's been playing with his phone right now.
Okay.
Well, that's not a cell phone.
No, that's not a cell phone.
That's Madison's been playing with his computer.
Okay, so to that end, the few slides here are going to be I'm going to talk about how businesses are taxed or pay income taxes, and that's both through the corporate income taxes and the personal income tax side. Now, the types of businesses that exist, sole proprietors are a very common type. Those are basically your one-person shops. Very easy to start up, low startup costs. Another type of business are partnerships. And here you can have general partnerships or limited liability partnerships. And a partnership exists. All it takes is two people to get together and form a business into a partnership. And the difference between general and limited liability is that with a limited liability, at least one partner has to have their liability limited through the corporation, through the partnership. The next type of business entity are corporations, and these are C corporations, which are your large corporations that people are familiar with, and then you have S corporations, which are generally smaller corporations. And they're smaller corporations in terms of the number of shareholders. Some of the differences between C and S corporations are that S corporations are limited to 100 shareholders and limited to one class of stock. C corporations can issue different classes of stock and can have any number of shareholders. So ability to raise capital is a key feature between the two of them, key difference. A relatively new type of business are limited liability companies. And they are a fast-growing type of business, and they're very popular among startups. And so how this factors into what we see on the tax side is that limited liability companies can choose how they want to be taxed. They can actually be taxed as C corporations, S corporations, partnerships, or they would be a kind of a sole proprietorship, and it depends on how many members there are. You can have a limited liability company that is a single member, and they could be taxed as a C or S corporation, or they could be what's referred to as a disregarded entity, and they would simply pay taxes as a sole proprietor. For multi-member LLCs, they would be partnerships, C-corps or S-corps. And for the most part, they are they choose to be taxed as partnerships. Now, to provide some context for the number of entities we're talking about here, there are two pie charts here. They're relatively the same. We have tax year 2000 and 2004, and we see that about 59% of all businesses are sole proprietors. S corporations are 12%, partnerships are 9 or 10%, and C corporations are 11% in 2000 and 9% in 2004. And then farms comprise another 10%. So the key thing here is that for businesses, 90% of businesses pay taxes through the personal income tax system, not the corporate tax system. And these are just the numbers of businesses that we're talking about. So in 2000, there were 358,000 businesses, and 208,000 of them were the sole proprietors. By 2004, the number of businesses had grown to 384,000. And again, relatively, the proportions are relatively the same, but we do see a decline in C corporations and an increase in S corporations and partnerships. And there has been, since 1986, there has been a shift from C corporations to S corporations, and a lot of that was started at the federal level with the Tax Reform Act of 1986 that changed the relative tax rates at the federal level and made it more appealing for businesses to be taxed as S corporations. In terms of income, here again we have tax year 2000 and tax year 2004. And we can see that in 2000, sole proprietors comprised $2.5 billion of taxable income and were the largest business entity in terms of taxable income. But by 2004, the C corporations had overtaken them for the top spot, so to speak, with over $3 billion of taxable income.
Oh, that's good.
$3 billion of income. And this slide here shows for different income categories the relative distribution of the types of businesses. So, for example, for businesses above $500,000, the amount of income, C corporations represent a relatively larger share of the biggest corporations, not surprisingly. And then they also represent a fairly large share of the businesses that had a loss. And we can see that S corporations have the same kind of presence at either end of the scale. And for the folks in the businesses in the middle of the scale here, those are the sole proprietors. And the last slide that I had is some information by sector for the C and S corporations. I don't have any information on the partnerships by sector, but here we can see that the S corporations are present in all the sectors. One sector that stands out are the construction companies. Well, we have 4,000 construction companies that are C corporations. Two-thirds of them, or 8,000, are actually S corporations. And we can see that kind of distribution is also there in the professional, scientific, and technical services sector as well.
Thank you, Chair. Representative Butler. Thank you. Chris, go back to the slide immediately before that, please. The smallest group there throughout is farm. And it would indicate that there's some different kind of return other than the sole proprietor corporate partnership that farms are reporting on that. What's that?
The farms are the Mr. Chair, Mr. Vice Chair. The farms are the Schedule F.
But Chris, if I may follow up, Mr. Chair.
Yes, please.
That can be on a sole proprietorship, or there'd be a 1040F, and I would use the F on the S corporation, the C corporation, and I would use it on the partnership as well. So, what's the distinction?
I don't have the breakdown across. Mr. Chair, Mr. Vice Chair, I don't have the breakdown for those types. It's just the only information I have is just the Schedule F, all lumped in together.
Okay. I guess, Mr. Chair, I'm just a little bit perplexed about that because farmers don't file a separate return. They're either individual sole proprietor, they're either an S corporation, they're either a partnership, or they're a C corporation. They don't really stand alone as just farms, but any one of those can file a Schedule F with it, which would be farming and fishing at that point too, agricultural businesses. So, I've seen that array of where the farmers are filing before, but I wondered why that was broken out as if they were filing a separate return, separate than any of the rest of the actual business returns.
Let me follow up on that too. When you included the farmers in this in that kind of light green band, are they extracted from all of the other lists so that they don't duplicate?
Yes.
Thanks,
Mr. Chair.
Yeah.
And I believe that it's a good question. By convention, I guess, or perhaps have it that they're just treated separately, and perhaps I could merge them in with the other information if that would be less confusing. I can do that in the future.
Sort of following up on that, I guess, that I don't know whether this is what Representative Butler had in mind or not, but what it does mean is that you're including a large corporate farm along with a small direct sales farm in the same category.
Yeah.
Yes.
Thank you. Other questions?
Yeah. Mr. Chair.
Berger, sorry.
Yes, Mr. Chair, if you go back, I can't help but note, because I had a similar question, Mr. Chair, about what's this farm category I didn't realize about a Schedule F. But if you go back one more slide, you'll see that it's pretty interesting in terms of how they're doing on their income. In that slide, I found it very interesting that they were separated out.
Well, the American farmer at risk.
How they doing the last 4 years?
If they grew onions this last year, they probably were okay.
Interesting problem. Of course, we know agriculture is one of our large sectors, so the fact that they didn't make any money in 2000 and they didn't make any money in 2004, I wonder what that tells us about the years in between.
Well, I don't want to belabor this, but to Representative Butler's point, if you took that negative and spread it out through the C's and the S's and the partnership, where would they drop? Which one would drop more is sort of an interesting question. I don't think they could. It isn't a big enough sector to change the whole scale or Chris's point about how they're doing. But if they were all S corps or all partnerships, I suspect they're mostly sole proprietorships. But I don't know.
Right.
Well, Mr. Chair, the interesting comment about that, though, is that we've heard for a long, long time this issue about, you know, what would the farmer do if he won the lottery? He'd farm until it was all gone. and here, probably what's happening is that you've got farmers who are supporting this terrible habit of trying to operate the family farm by utilizing spouses that work off farm and bring income in, or other kinds of business ventures. And I guess the one business venture that does file a separate return that I don't see up there is the fiduciary. I know that there are fiduciaries that file Schedules F as well as file on a Schedule C and those kinds of things. The fiduciaries don't make enough business income to even show up on the scale at all. Chris?
Mr. Chair, Representative, I didn't separate them out. I didn't specifically look at them. I think that the idea here is, I don't know, I think I've struck a chord with this almost by accident, was just that the farms had been treated separately and then a lot of the information, so I wasn't pulling them out to make some other kind of statement. I would add that this is collective for all the farms. There are those that do have positive income in each of the years and those that have losses.
Right.
I would note that there are several different ways of analyzing this data, and of course you've given us two of them really. I think one is the by type of return that people file with this little mix of the farm thrown in, and then on the last slide that you prepared, you also divided up corporations by the category of work that they're in. Yeah, that one. And I noticed on that one, the very last item is agriculture and forestry, which shows that these are simply the numbers of businesses, aren't they? They don't have anything to do with the relative income or anything of that sort.
Correct, Mr. Chair.
I think another slide that might be useful as we look at this from a more general economic point of view would be how the different categories stack up. I know we have this data in terms of their contribution to the gross state product and also to the tax system. It based on the not on the way in which they're organized, but on the kind of business they're in, as you've got said here. But of course, we'd want to include sole proprietorships and partnerships as well as the corporations for that on that list, and that might get a little bit closer to what some of the issues that Representative Butler was raising as well. It also, I think, might help us when we look at when we're looking at both tax credits and some of our tax expenditure issues as we go along. So that might be something for a future day. I know we've got the data. It may just not be broken up that way yet.
That's correct, Mr. Chair. A lot of the information, it's a mishmash of piecing the data together. That's one challenge. And this was just meant to be, my intent here was just kind of a high level to touch on. Here's some of the information. It really, as a starting point in the purpose of today, is to, within the vein of the purpose of today, is to talk about business taxation. There is a great deal of work that can be done to pull this information together, to get income by form type, by industry. There are limitations to the data as well. For example, partnerships. I don't think we have that from the tax side by industry, and on the sole proprietors, some work can be done there too. I mean, it's a great deal of work. On the part of, for example, the Department of Revenue. It's not part of the main system in terms of the information that they gather. Now, on the Schedule Cs, businesses do fill in an industry code, so the possibility is there to gather some of the information.
So we're not using data then from the Department of Labor that would give us those categories.
Correct, Mr. Chair.
And I remember when I was in practice, I had to fill out these questionnaires, and one of the things I wanted to know was what kind of a business I was in.
Right.
From the Department of Labor. So the information might be available, but not through the same sources.
That's exactly
right. So matching income and taxation to categories might be very difficult.
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Yeah,
and the perspective here really was the tax system. And so we see...
Yes.
So from that perspective, that provides a certain vantage point on businesses.
Thank you. Other questions that this discussion has generated... Representative Butler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I appreciate your last comment there, Chris. This is relative to the taxation. Farmers do have a different form of taxation in some respects, and certainly with income averaging, it's still an issue for farmers. So thank you.
Thank you very much. Thank you, Chris, and I think we'll go on to our business panel.
Okay. Actually, I've got some material.
Oh, good. Give us some material.
And I wanted to walk through the packet before we get to our business panel, and those are really the other things on your outline. The first thing is on the household business taxes. I went back into the archives and got a piece called Oregon's Tax Shift, and you notice the date on there is March 1998.
Mm-hmm.
And this was an issue that was tracked by the office for a number of years because we had so many questions about it. In particular, it was in the context of Measure 5. That Measure 5, the phase-in, coincided with a shift in what we call the initial incidence of taxes between households and businesses. In the final incidence analysis, we try to go beyond that, like, for example, in the OTIM analysis. But you can see the shift really was from a total shift in the share from 78-79, where it was about 49% business, through to 96-97, accelerating during the phase-in of Measure 5 to 39.6% business and 60.4% households. And you can see the reasons for the shift, and primarily the reason for that shift was market trends and property values. Measure 5 was a market value system, and the residential property increased far faster than did commercial and industrial property values during the first half of the 90s. And that was really the major factor behind that shift. There's a couple of others that are interesting. We used to have a large section, if you look back on our material and the work of the Revenue Committee back in the 80s, on homeowner property tax relief programs. Those were phased out with the difficult times in the early 80s, and then by the time Measure 5 came in, they were basically abandoned altogether, with the exception of the senior deferral program that you talked about. So that broad relief was gone, and in terms of relief to households, and so the property tax became basically spread across the entire burden with no favorable treatment for residential property. And then the final point is that income taxes, and we'll see this again in the next information I have, as we shifted from income taxes away from property taxes, we're shifting in general away from the major tax that business pays, the major state and local tax, the largest tax they pay, and that's the property tax, toward the income tax, which, as we've seen through Chris's numbers, is paid by business, but still a lot smaller percentage than either the property tax or the sales tax. We have not updated this, and the reason why we have not done that is we think there's a pretty good an annual analysis that's produced by Ernst & Young. They do it for the Council on State Taxation, and I've made a copy of that for you. I think they'll be coming out with a new one pretty soon. This is for the 2005 year, and what Ernst & Young does is this analysis for all the states. Now, we have a few quibbles with what they do, but it's a consistent measure across the states. And if you look on page 2 of that, there's some introductory stuff. And then the second page in the text there, it has page 2 listed on the bottom. You can see all of the state and local business taxes that they have listed and where the percentages are. And there's a couple of things that I think are important to recognize. That is that property and general sales taxes that businesses pay make up about 60% of total state and local taxes on business. So those are the major components if we look at the entire national system. Corporate income taxes get a lot of interest, but yet they're only 8.5% of state and local taxes. So they are considerably smaller than the others, barely larger than payroll taxes or gross receipts taxes. So that kind of gives you a breakdown of what the states do as a whole. If you look on page 4, you can see some trends that they've identified. The fastest growth during the period was in payroll taxes. The slowest was in sales taxes. But overall, business taxes have grown slightly faster than total state and local taxes for this 3-year period. On the next page, on page 5, it shows you something you're very much aware of and why we talk about the corporate kicker. I like this chart because it's a comparison of all state taxes with the corporate income tax. And you can see, again, that extreme volatility of the corporate income tax shows up in those numbers. On page 7, you can see the breakdown of all of those business taxes by state. And that just gives the total. They have identified $4.3 billion in state and local business taxes for 2005 in Oregon. And you can see how that breaks down, the largest being property tax in Oregon as well at $1.8 billion. The next page gives you some comparisons on percentages, and this gets to the share idea. If you look at Oregon, Oregon's business taxes are about 3.8% of gross state product for 2005. And the share is about 34.3. So we're right down near the bottom in terms of the share paid by business taxes on initial incidents. The biggest reason for that is not what I think most people would identify immediately, but the biggest reason is because we don't have a sales tax. And that's the second largest tax paid by by businesses. So without a sales tax and then a personal income tax being such a huge factor, they do in this analysis account for some of the things that Chris was talking about. They account for all pass-through income and identify that as business income and the personal income tax, but they really don't account for those sole proprietors. So there's a little bit of an understatement on the personal income tax side. So, but that kind of gives you a sense of those overall shares.
Just a moment, excuse me. It appears to me that only Connecticut has a lower business share, if I scan it quickly.
Mm-hmm.
Doesn't Connecticut have a sales tax?
Connecticut does have a sales tax, yes.
So it must be some other reason for Connecticut to be that low.
I can't identify right off, Mr. Chair. Connecticut does have the highest per capita income in the nation. So there may be some issue around that in terms of their income tax.
Okay.
So some revenue through that.
All right. Every state is a little different, mm-hmm. isn't it? Thank you.
And, you know, for example, another example just below there is Delaware is seen as kind of a business haven because they're in corporation laws. Well, you know, those corporate taxes show up there as a business tax. So they come across with a very high business share. Yet that's because they have favorable laws for incorporation. Really, it's they encourage that revenue to come in. I guess the question I put on your outline is, what does this mean? Well, you know, there's some answers in this tax shift we had in 98. It does affect perceptions, and it does affect ultimately how taxes are paid. We tend to prefer looking at final incidents in which we try to map through how business taxes ultimately work through the system. If they affect owners of capital, they tend to have a progressive effect, perhaps a more of an economic growth effect. If they affect prices, then they tend to be more regressive. So just because a tax is borne by business initially doesn't mean whether it's regressive or progressive. That has to be traced down to a final step. But the other thing that we wanted to bring out about this are the different options. I like this table one because it does show you all the taxes that Ernst & Young has identified throughout the state and local system that are business taxes, and including these individual income taxes on pass-throughs. So that gives you kind of a map to go back to when you can look at a comparison with other states. I wanted to just say a couple of things about the corporate income tax, and I'll say some things and refer to the article I've clipped out for you on Ohio tax reform efforts, which is most articles about Ohio refer to that darn cat. And those of you who are on the 01 committee, I don't know if there's anybody here who was on the 01 revenue committee now. Well, Representative Shetterly had a proposal on the business activity tax that he called the BAT. Well, this is the CAT, is what Ohio has passed. It's a commercial activities tax. And this article talks about the reasons, their process they went through, the reasons for making these decisions, and the notion that this may be an alternative way to tax business. We've had a couple of states, Kentucky, for example, Texas, that have followed suit somewhat in this direction since then. So this article kind of identifies that process. One of the things I wanted to refer to is if you go to page 28, I'll just start. There are a few things about this. Page 28, not actually 28 on the handout, it's page number 28. They talk about the corporate franchise tax in Ohio. That's really a corporate income tax. And when you looked at their corporate income tax and they had a local option on top of it, it could be among the highest in the country. It was 8.5%, and you had a potential of a 1.6% local option pushing it above 10%. So they had a lot of pressure in dealing with their corporate income tax. And basically they made the decision, as they say in the beginning of that corporate franchise tax discussion, rather than trying to make changes in the corporate income tax, such as requiring combined reporting, which you do here in Oregon, instituting throwback, which we have, changing the apportionment factor, which you've done, they simply scrapped it and went to this alternative. And the reasons behind that are really spelled out, I think, pretty well on page 29, the next page. They talk about how abandoning a corporate income tax may be criticized for abandoning the ability to pay principle, but tax planning had already seriously eroded the ability to pay basis for a corporate income tax. And their argument essentially against the corporate income tax is that the difficulties around taxing business on their, as they call it, purported profits. Their argument is the profits tax is not very administratively efficient because of the ceaseless battle with corporations over the measurement of income within the state. Often in response to cutting-edge tax planning techniques developed by those corporate lawyers and accountants. So
those darn corporate accountants.
Those darn corporate accountants.
Yeah. They're always in the background. But their argument essentially is administratively inefficient tax. And so the solution that they've come up with is a different approach to business taxation, which is based on the principle, which is based on what we call the benefit principle. And that is that a tax on business pays the state is more closely based on the benefits that it receives, whether the business is nominally profitable or not. And that's on the top of page 29.
I wonder if accountants have been around in the 16th century, if Shakespeare would have referred to them instead of lawyers.
No.
No.
Questions, etc.
Go ahead, Paul.
So on page 30, it just kind of outlines what they've come up with the CAT. The CAT has three tiers, and whether it's based on the size of a company's gross receipts. So it's really a gross receipts tax, is what it is. It's businesses whose annual Ohio gross receipts are less than $150,000 do not file, do not pay tax. So they're not even required to file.
Gross receipts, taxable gross receipts.
Businesses whose taxable gross receipts are greater than $150,000 but less than or equal to $1 million pay an annual minimum tax of $150. And businesses whose annual taxable gross receipts are greater than $1 million pay $150 on the first million and 0.26 for the gross receipts over $1 million.
You left out the key word. 0.26%.
0.26%, right. So a quarter of a percent.
Right.
They pay a quarter of a percent is the rate. So the Ohio experiment is being observed and watched by a number of states. They've had some suits. The grocers, for example, in the state were opposed to it, arguing that they're unfairly penalized. There's typically what you see in the two biggest arguments against that kind of approach. One is that some of the negative effects associated with the possibility of cascading, in which gross receipts, if it's based on gross receipts, you can double up that tax as it goes through the production process. Mm-hmm. That does create some economic inefficiencies. What Ohio has done in their approach is they have made the tax destination-based, so that if you are an Ohio company and you're exporting your product to Illinois, you're not subject to the gross receipts tax. If you're an Illinois company selling your product in Ohio, you are subject to the gross receipts tax, to the CAT. Mm-hmm. So that's, of course, as you imagine, created some
Sounds like a single sales factor to me.
It's a consumption-based tax, and the single sales is a consumption-based tax.
Right.
So it certainly moves into that direction. And basically what they're saying is rather than go that route through the corporate income tax structure, they created this whole new structure.
Mr. Chair,
Representative Butler.
Paul, how do they tax insurance companies and banks? It's got to be a premium tax and a... you can't tax a bank based upon the cash transactions.
No, it's not a transactions tax. So they do have a proxy for what their receipts are. I can't remember what that is.
Okay.
But they do have special rules for them.
All right. Thank you.
You can see why the grocers would have been unhappy with that.
Oh, my.
Since they turn over their entire inventory about every 2 weeks. Mm-hmm. The jeweler's shop, on the other hand, that turns over every 18 months or so, should be much happier with this approach.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. These diamonds are getting kind of ripe.
Yeah.
So it's kind of an interesting experience. At the end, they talk about the lessons learned. You may want to look at that. And you know, essentially what their case is, and this is written by folks at the Ohio Department of Taxation, is the lesson is to not let the perfect be the enemy of the good. The theoretical reasons to prefer a value-added tax, such as the VAT we talked about in this committee, to a gross receipts tax. However, they say that this is a more practical means of implementing the general benefit principle of taxation. So I thought that's kind of going around the circles among tax experts as a trend. It has some pluses and minuses, but I thought that would be something to think about. As you look at a corporate minimum tax, and you introduced a bill today. You've got a bill from the governor. You got a bill from the interim Senate committee. So you've got corporate minimum proposals out there. Most of those are based on Oregon sales. So they're kind of starting to go down this path. And whenever you look at a corporate minimum, you know, my argument to people that say, gee, it's ridiculous that a corporation would be paying $10. Well, if net income is your base and they don't have any net income, they should be paying zero. So you're really kind of implying a different base. So this is where kind of give you an idea, start thinking about what the implications might be down this path. The last thing I'll say before we go to our business panel is our friends to the north, of course, sometimes they're behind and sometimes there's ahead. And if you stay in the same place, I guess you can go from being behind to being ahead. But they, of course, have been operating a business and occupation tax since the 30s. And that B&O tax in Washington, I was looking at the Forecast Council's 07-09 projections, they expect to generate $5.5 billion through their B&O tax in 07-09. So if you look at personal income, Washington's almost exactly double our size. So that would be about 2¾ billion. Through our corporate income tax, for example, we're about a fourth of that. It just spells out the B&O tax from Department of Revenue, and the one thing I was going to refer to is the rates. If you look on the fourth page there, that printout, it shows you the rates that they have. Pretty similar for this lowest category, but they tend to be higher than the CAT for most of producers. And you get up to 0.0084, which would be 0.48%, about 0.5%. Manufacturing fits into that category. And then they have some that are taxed at higher rates, mostly gaming activities. And public and nonprofit hospitals, I assume, are part of a kind of a medical provider type mechanism that we've also had. So, again, that gives you a sense of kind of where other states are and what those alternatives might be.
Very good. Thank you. So, should we call up our business panel? Mr. Thompson, Mr. Craven, Mr. Wilson.
Mr. Chair, while you're coming up, I'd like to thank Paul for providing my weekend reading at the beach.
Thanks, Paul.
Great. wasn't what I had in mind this weekend for reading at the beach.
Both riveting and soporific.
Yes.
Gentlemen.
You guys have got specific things you want to talk about.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, Jim Craven, American Electronics Association. I'm trying not to make this a daily adventure.
So far,
but I wasn't invited.
But
I was invited or commanded or whatever. A few weeks ago, when you had our distinguished economist, one from out of state who must be very distinguished because he's from out of state, and one from University of Oregon, there was a bit of a dialogue about whether businesses even care about taxes. I sort of joked to the chair, if you come to that conclusion that we don't tell my clients because we spend too much time in this room as it is. And some experts will argue and make a case that that taxes are not the most important issue for business, particularly in business citing decisions. You saw a lot of charts on that. And some will argue that taxes aren't very important at all in the grand scheme of things. But and I think my argument would be that just because state and local taxes may not be the most important factor for business, they are an important factor. And so it's a false dilemma to say, well, are taxes the most important thing in your business? Well, no. The most important thing to business is to make a return on capital and a return to your investors. And a business that doesn't achieve those goals is, in the long term, won't exist. It won't be, in the modern parlance, sustainable. Business achieves a goal by providing innovative goods and services to customers in an increasingly competitive and global marketplace. And the amount of return on investment is obviously related to a host of factors. Good products, good people, good location, access to markets, good financial controls over your business, and so on. And taxes are a factor in that broad general equation about trying to achieve a return on capital. A location's tax structure, I would have some argument with our out-of-state guest from a few weeks ago. I think a location's tax structure can play an especially or critical role in the decision to site particularly a large capital-intensive facility, and we've had some experience of that in Oregon. If a location's property tax structure, for instance, places an inordinate financial benefit on a facility purely because of the billions of dollars that it takes to build that structure, and places a burden that's way out of any kind of benefits received return in terms of how many employees, how much you're using the highway, how many kids you have in school, if that is way out of kilter, then those making the siting decisions may look elsewhere. And the important factor here is that companies do have choices. They have choices of cities, they have choices of states, and they increasingly have choices of countries. And it's important to recognize that decisions by world-class companies to locate in a state, say Oregon, can influence the decisions of many other players. In the mid-70s, 1974 and 1976, two fairly well-known companies today, Intel and Hewlett-Packard, made independent decisions to come to Corvallis and Aloha. And those decisions of world-class companies sent a signal to a lot of other world-class companies that if Intel decided to expand in Oregon or Hewlett-Packard went to Oregon, there must be something worth looking at in Oregon because I think those people do a pretty good job in making such decisions. You know, recently, the world's oldest and most successful biotech firm, Genentech, made the decision to expand a major manufacturing facility in Hillsboro, Oregon. It's the first location for Genentech, which is a 30-year-old company, their first location outside of California, and they picked Oregon. And they have said in a number of very public pronouncements, and they're not a member of mine, so I don't coach them. They're a biotech firm, have said without any cautions or sideboards that the move of this legislature over the last several years to move to a single sales factor apportionment was not a factor, the deciding critical factor, which is allowing them to build a $250 million facility in Hillsboro and employ 300 family wage jobs. So I'm not guessing on that. I believe the companies get to say what's important to them, and that's what they've said in fairly public forums.
Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Do you anticipate, Jim, that there's some spinoff from that? Remember the discussion we had, I think, with Michael Potter 2 years ago at the Business Summit, talked about clusters, and we were trying to determine the health cluster surrounding the Oregon Health and Science University and now Trotty and some of those kinds of things. Will there be some potential major corporate benefits of locating now, and ancillary companies that hire fewer than a few thousand people?
Well, Chair Barnhart, Representative Butler, one can only speculate, and I don't track the biotech industry all that well, but the only point I'm trying to make here is, you know, people understand that there are smart companies out there, and when the world sees Genentech making its first choice out of South San Francisco to Hillsboro, Oregon, has to send some positive signals. And I think this, in talking to the Genentech folks a couple of weeks ago, I don't think they see this as a one-time and only kind of investment. I mean, it is a it's an investment, and I think they've said to me that they're, you know, see how things go, and there may be some more. So
good. Thank you.
You know, I think states have choices too. Companies have choices, and states have choices, and states can choose to compete in attracting and retaining businesses, or they can choose not to. That's not fundamentally a choice of good or bad or right or wrong or evil or whatever, but it is a choice. And those who would argue otherwise, who'd argue that to ignore the elements of competition and choice, I think are refusing to acknowledge the world as it is and is becoming more so every day. And I think, thankfully, for the past 20 years, Oregon has chosen to compete. And it's chosen over five governors, one Republican, four Democrats, with a legislature run by Democrats, with a legislature run by Republicans, to make some significant bold choices in this regard. And it's going to review these very quickly, going back to Vicatia, calling a special session of the legislature to change the unitary tax system. You know, it's sort of a arcane reason to have a special session, but Governor Tia believed in it. This state made that choice, and it led to hundreds of millions of dollars of Japanese-based investment in Oregon. Governor Goldschmidt was the first governor to implement the research and development tax credit in Oregon, and this is way back then. In fact, my first session lobbying was when Oregon went to a 50% sales factor. So this issue about apportionment has been around for a long time in this building. Governor Barbara Roberts took the initiative on the strategic investment program. That was Governor Barbara Roberts' bill, and that had led to billions of dollars of investment in Washington and Multnomah counties. Governor Kitzhaber, it was during that era when we approved the move to so-called rolling reconnect, and those who are on this committee last session remember that debate. We took a little hiatus from it in the recession, but we returned to it last session, and that was first done under Governor Kitzhaber, who also signed a bill moving us down the road on the corporate apportionment formula. And, of course, you know, current Governor Kulongoski, with the support of this body, went all the way to 100% sales last session and also supported an increase in the research and development tax credit. We all recognize how difficult the last economic downturn was in Oregon, but sort of imagine how difficult it may have been if we hadn't taken steps in the 80s and 90s to diversify our economy. And I think some of these bold steps in the revenue taxation, corporate taxation thing played a key role in that diversification. These moves get noticed, and they get noticed by those businesses who are looking for states that get it, looking for states that understand that the world economy is changing, the way we tax people is changing, the way people sell products is changing, and companies are looking for states that show that they have some kind of understanding that the world is indeed changing. So as you discuss issues involving business taxation, I would hope that you'd consider some of this history, some of the history in Oregon. States that succeed in the 21st century are those that will have explicit strategies to attract and retain so-called traded sector companies, the companies that employ Oregonians, pay high wages, invest in the state, and sell most of their products in global markets. This is the prize that we need to keep our eyes on. You know, pie charts and arbitrary discussions about how it used to be 20 years ago and whether it was 18% then and it's 19% now, while interesting, I think from an academic point of view, I'm not sure always recognize that many things fundamentally have changed, and looking in a rearview mirror doesn't always provide direction for the future. I did finally get around to slugging my way through Tom Friedman's book just a couple weeks ago. It seems like everybody in the world claims to have read it, but it is 700 pages long. And one thing sticks in my mind among a lot of observations he makes, where he says that societies and cultures and nation states are defined by a fundamental difference in whether they are characterized by memories or dreams. And what he means is, do you basically focus your eye on how it used to be, or do you focus your eye on how it is today and how it's going to be in the future? And that stuck with me. He was talking more about the Middle East and other issues in that chapter. But, you know, do we look back or do we look forward? And I think that's excellent advice. As to the needs of the state for revenue, I don't want to get off without touching on that subject. You know, we absolutely agree in what was developed by the Oregon Shines Project 15, 20 years ago, the so-called Circle of Prosperity, in that a very healthy private sector generates wages and taxes to fuel the needs of a healthy public sector. And it's a circle. It's not two separate things. And it starts with a healthy private sector, and it fuels a healthy public sector. And we support well-funded public services, and we want to work with you on addressing those needs. So I think strategies that focus on creating high-wage jobs first is the main goal that we ought to be focused on. Just in the interest of blatant self-promotion, a couple of facts about the high-tech sector that I represent. We do an annual study of every 50 states, and we look at a lot of this public available data. The wages we pay to our 82,000 workers in Oregon average about $71,000 a year per job. That is 103% higher than the average private wage in Oregon. And actually, Oregon's number four among the states in that difference in terms of, if you work in high tech in Oregon, how does it compare to everybody else working in Oregon? We're number four in the whole country. So that delta is important. Both the nominal number and the delta are important. And I think you'll find similar numbers with the lumber and wood products industry, with our metals and transportation manufacturing sector. In fact, the manufacturing sector in general are the kinds of jobs that pay high-wage jobs. They provide health care for their workers. They provide pension benefits to their workers. They provide educational benefits for their workers. And so, you know, whatever we decide to do about corporate taxation in the abstract, even if we were to have fundamental tax reform in Oregon, the most important thing to keep our eyes on is that finding strategies to create high-wage jobs. And until that day when we have fundamental tax reform where taxes won't have any relationship to what people make and somehow we'll sales tax everything into getting the revenue we need, we are, as you all know, absolutely dependent upon the personal income tax to fuel the state, to provide for public services. So creating some of the discussions that Representative Witt is having in his committee about how do we have that basic economy that provides high-wage jobs is something that's critical. Otherwise, you know, our system doesn't work. So I think I'm going to end there. Stability obviously is important, and we had that conversation the last few days in this committee. How do we provide a little more stability, a little sheltering from future storms? You guys get to all have a nice conversation about that next week, I suppose. And down the road, I suppose, we're going to have a discussion about corporate minimum tax, and we'll be willing to engage in that discussion with you. So thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Mr. Olson.
Thank you, Chair Barnhart. Members of the committee, for the record, J.L. Wilson, representing NFIB. My little segment of the world with NFIB members, probably a bit less dynamic than Jim's folks. We're talking about local companies operating in local markets. You're not going to see global competitors in our ranks for the most part. But I agree with Jim, what Jim has to say, primarily because the $71,000 average salary that he pays his workers obviously has a huge, tremendous positive benefit on the small companies that I represent. It really fuels a lot of the small locally based companies. By way of background, you know, I represent that segment of the business community that is largely self-employed. Oregon, coincidentally, based on our calculations, has the third highest rate of self-employment in the country behind Alaska and Montana. But for our folks, 60% of my membership has between one and five employees. So we're talking the smaller folks. And it's getting very difficult to really divorce the owner from the business because with our companies, what you're talking about an 85% clip, you're seeing the S corporations, partnerships, LLCs, those types of entities. When you're talking about business income, you're really talking about the business owner's income. And when you talk about income and who makes what in this state, our typical member, now we surveyed last, just a couple years ago, the average NFIB business owner made about $40,000-$41,000. I imagine that's ratcheted up just a bit, but you get the picture. These are, middle-class folks who are engaged in business. The principles that we employ on taxes, you catch wind of the issues that we work on that are interesting to us, primarily estate taxes. I don't want to compromise the ability of one business owner to pass on business to another generation. We're interested in those things that promote investment, whether it's through capital gains or investment tax credits. But really, from a small business perspective, there are just a couple core principles that we focus on because there are very few issues that everybody can coalesce around. And one of those is, for a small company, cash flow is everything. Retained earnings is the vehicle for business growth and sustenance and sustainability. And so we are very focused on those things that would enhance cash flow. We're very interested in simplicity. Simplicity probably more than anything else. I can talk about taxes we like and dislike, and probably you won't find that we like many taxes, but you would expect that from most folks. But the one tax that we try to avoid, most folks don't like taxes that aren't tied to income in some way. So we do have an aversion to payroll taxes, and you'll hear me talk about the corporate minimum as that progresses. But things that aren't tied to profitability or earnings, we tend not to be in favor of. So we have just kind of a few guiding principles of how we look at taxes, but for the most part, you kind of get the flavor of what we're after. I'm assuming you'll have questions at the end after we're done, so I'll be glad to expand as we progress.
Thank you. Mr. Thompson.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'm Warren Thompson. I'm a CPA with the accounting firm of Wendedahl, Rangage & Thompson. Don't ask me to spell that. I've been doing this for over 30 years. Shocked me when I realized that. It's time to go get a real job. There's a couple of things that need to be talked about. One is Oregon's tax shift. That, I believe, is a function of individuals making significantly greater incomes over the period looked at, and certainly now, than corporations. Corporations have not had the chance to grow their incomes as much as individuals have. When I started this, there were very few people that paid the maximum Oregon tax rate of 10%. Very few. And now everybody, even those making minimum wage, is paying marginal 9% tax rate. And there's a lot of corporations that just aren't making haven't had that kind of increase over the last 30 years. We've had some new big ones come in, but we've had some old big ones go out. Our clientele over the past 5 to 8 years has changed their form of doing business. Corporations are primarily now all S corporations. And there's numerous reasons for that, mostly related with tax planning issues. We have taken advantage with many of our new businesses with this magic thing that you people were gracious enough to create called the LLC, Limited Liability Company. It's a great thing if you want to have a business that's got a fixed term and you don't want to go to all that other hassle of being a corporation. The key thing to our clients, for them to locate and expand in Oregon, and we have had a number of clients that went up to Washington because the overall tax picture was more stable in Washington than it has been in Oregon. So their expansions and somewhere around 500 jobs are in Washington, not Oregon. The key thing for us and for our clients is for the tax picture to be stable and predictable. That's just so important. As Jim was talking about Genentech, they came here because you, over the past 15 or so years, have created a relatively stable, predictable tax structure. And as tempting as it is to go in and tweak it a little bit here and a little bit there, I would do that with great reluctance if I were sitting up there, simply because what we have ain't broke, and so it don't need fixed. On the issue of minimum tax, is $10 a ridiculous number? Maybe. Unless you've had a very large loss. We've got a client lost $250,000 last year because they had a construction job go bad on them. $10 to them meant something. And the numbers that they're doing, if you have the graduated tax, would have been somewhere in the $5,000 range from what I've seen from various charts going around. That would have been very close to shutting them down. They were in that tight of a situation. So, with that, I guess we're all ready for questions.
Thank you. That's your RQ. Members of the committee. Start at the end, Representative Brown.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Jill, I want to probe you a little bit on your comment about cash flow and how important it is to your businesses, especially the smaller businesses, support all business. Talk about, if you will, what you see as a government's role, and is it get out of the way and leave us be, or is there some proactive measure that this committee and the legislature can, you know, are the specific things you're talking about this year?
Thank you, Chair Barnhart, Representative Bruin. You notice that we don't come around the legislature asking for much, because really we more or less tend to just want to operate without a lot of interference. And I'm looking here at the top 10 problems that, you know, if you're an NFIB member, the one thing you get accustomed to is being surveyed out of your mind.
Well, even if you're not a member, just a small business.
Right.
Yeah.
And, you know, I'm looking here at the top 10 business issues. Number one for the last 20 years has been cost of health insurance, but federal taxes on business is number two, state taxes on business income is six, cash flow is number nine, and if you go to number 11, frequent changes in federal tax laws and rules. So basically four of the top 11 deal with taxes in some way, shape, or form. And really, you know, I like what my colleague here down on the end said, and that is a level of predictability and stability is really golden for us and something that we can count on. And, you know, we're going to get into the minimum tax discussion and things like that, but on issues, you know, I hear my business owners say, well, if I'm paying taxes, that means I must be making something. And so, you know, I hear that a lot. So that's why we tend to, when we talk about a fair discussion of taxes, I like to steer things toward taxes on earnings as opposed to taxes just based on your gross sales or something like that, because it really doesn't have bearing on what you made.
Thank you, Representative Berger.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Gentlemen, would you pursue just a little bit further the interface between NFIB and AEA in terms of this? I was an NFIB member. I had a very small business, six employees, and my lifeblood in a sort of a half-retail environment was just the daily little business. But without the big guns, I knew I was sunk, and how they did was how I did. I could I could do a certain amount of churn with business to business and retail, but in the end, there's, in my mind, a huge connection that you seem like separate, but you're not at all, in my mind.
Chair Barnhart and Representative Berger, it's a really interesting discussion when you get around small business versus big business, because there's a little, it gets a little schizophrenic. And your point is well taken, Representative Berger, and that is, you know that when your big core industries do well and have well-paid employees, that your local businesses should thrive and do well. But you also have this other dynamic of the small business guy who doesn't like to think that they're getting the short end of the stick, that the big business guy is the one getting all the advantages, the big business guy is being catered to in the, you know, the halls of Congress or the halls of legislature. And you see those kind of battles bear out, you know, just the issue of, say, utility taxes last year with Senate Bill 408 was a classic big small business issue. And so it's an interesting dichotomy, but I tend to generally agree with what you say, and that is core industries like what Jim or the timber industry or high tech, you know, they in large part help sustain our small local-based companies without question.
Mr. Chair, Representative Berger, you know, I absolutely agree. My best friend is a restaurateur, and he keeps an eye on major expansions at Intel or Nike because he wants to put a restaurant down the street because he knows there's traffic and he knows there's people with money in their pocket. Several years ago, when Intel was still paying very large end-of-year bonuses, sometimes equal to 100% of salary, I tell you, the local merchants in the Tri-County area felt it. They knew in the day those checks were released, particularly the car dealers, but that's maybe not the smallest business, but they knew it. I think the difference is, you know, when you look at economic strategy theory, you need to be able to bring money into a state, and that's to increase the overall wealth of a locality, whether it's a nation state or a state of the U.S. And that's what your traded sector companies do. They basically sell stuff to somewhere else to bring in cash. And if you are successful at that, then that cash will then get turned around in the local service economy. I mean, you can't really have one of, you can't just have a service economy, as people say, you know, we're all washing each other's laundry. But the larger the wealth generating industry generates new net wealth that then flushes out through the whole economy. So I don't, you know, we sometimes get into these small versus large debates, and I respect everything JL said. You know, the person who's struggling, who may be selling a whole bunch of hamburgers, but at the end of the year doesn't have a lot of net income to be told that they need to be taxed on that churning, it's tough. It's a different issue for the people I represent. So, you know, it's not, one is not right and one is not wrong. It's just different.
Thank you. Did you have another one?
No, but somebody does behind you.
Oh, sorry. Representative Butler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Gentlemen, and I, there's a lot of systems out there of taxation. At least 50 of them that are before us in the documents we've got today, of total taxation. And it's not income taxation necessarily. It's not business taxation or commercial activity taxation like Ohio is doing, or business activity tax that we talked about here in Oregon a few years ago. Is there one system that's better than any other? You know, one of these days we're going to get it right, and then everybody's going to go to that. So where do we go from here, guys?
Go straight. Mr. Chair, Representative Butler, I am I have a hard time understanding Oregon's tax system, and I'm really not an expert. But what I do know, so it's going to be anecdotal, from talking to the companies that I represent in Oregon, clearly for I have 180 members. I've got a lot of small businesses too in my association. They're not all Intel and Hewlett Packard and Tektronix. We've got small startup companies doing software, five people in a rented space. So, you know, we're not all the mega corporations. Clearly, we have done some very important strategic decisions on those large capitally intensive facilities. No doubt about it. Oregon is known as probably one of the premier states, and the proof is in the $20 billion or so of investment that have resulted from the SIP program and others. So I think at that level, clearly, and there's lots of other issues, obviously. Power costs aren't what they used to be. Water is not what it used to be. Those clear advantages Oregon had are not what they used to be. So we'll see as we move forward. But I think among my members, small and large, medium and large, I think they are not critics of the Oregon system of taxation. The one thing that if I get 50 CEOs in a room and I ask them to raise their hand, I try to avoid surveying them because I know what they'll tell me. They're going to say Oregon's capital gains tax is just way out of whack. And they will say that if we ask them. And it, and again, capital gains gets portrayed often as a business issue. It really is an individual issue who may be a business person, may be a sole proprietor, may be a farmer, whatever. But it is the one issue that I just, in all honesty, have to say after 20 years, it's the one thing that people will say, it's kind of out of whack here, and it does lead to some decision-making about where to locate, particularly at the end of a career, particularly when you're liquidating a business. 9% of my net wealth, I'd move to Camas, I save it. Now, is that a huge population? I don't know, but it is an issue we hear about, just to be honest.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Businesses locate here, irrespective of the fact that there might be a high capital gains tax, they continue to come. Are businesses generally affected by sales taxes? We see in the discussion of the 50 states here that sales tax can be a significant issue to sales or to corporations and businesses. Is that a factor when they're looking over the array of the 50 states as a place to go? Sales tax.
Well, Mr. Chair, Representative Butler, I'm glad your staff pointed out the fact that I think in the cost study, is it about 30%, Paul? We oftentimes think of sales taxes as purely something that households pay, and it is not the case. And the reason why, if you look at these gross macroeconomic analyses, why Oregon's business taxes look lower than the average, that's the key factor, not a key, it's the key factor as well as measure five. Because business pays on inputs on sales taxes. Now, when we have these sales tax debates, we haven't had a good one in this room for several years, but when we do, many of the business sector will come in and talk to you about potential exemptions from the sales tax, and we've all been guilty of that. Then they'll make the, and many states do that. They recognize to some sectors, a major manufacturing sector, some states will have business sales tax exemptions in addition to the typical food and clothing and drugs and the things we think about for the individuals. So, yeah, sales tax does affect business, and some states that have sales taxes make accommodations for that.
Finally, Mr. Chair, if I may, Jim, you brought up the point of the capital gains. A few years ago, we actually made some allowance for farmers who were actually liquidating their entire operations and bailing out. Part of that was the Klamath Basin issue. But certainly the issue that we've seen today, that farmers, after they've farmed their whole lives, much of what they've done in that negative income over 2000 through 2004 is they've used up much of their capital base when they liquidate. Consequently, there's really little reason to charge them a 9% tax as they're bailing out. We actually lowered the tax rate on the farming industries that were liquidating in Oregon. I learned recently that there are some folks that are selling some pretty substantial interests in property here in Oregon. Those folks have all relocated. All of the principals in that business have all relocated out of state now, every one of them. Cost to the state is going to be somewhere in the vicinity of nearly $1 billion in loss of revenue from that, with the trickle-down effect is going to be pretty substantial, too. I'm wondering if we shouldn't at least consider trying to say to those folks, hey, if you're really going to sell your business and bail out of Oregon for good, why don't we cut your capital, do the same thing we did for farmers,
cut your capital gains rate in half so that you can stay here. And they don't have to play this game of not being an Oregonian anymore, and that you can really stay in Oregon. Would that encourage folks? The CPA should be able to. And we did have a CPA in here a couple of years ago that said with the presentation of the tax folder. They said the number one counsel we give our clients is we'd be derelict. We might even be sued if we don't tell you that by moving 55 miles away, you could reduce your taxes by 9%.
That is correct. And the outflow of people that are retiring to Washington, people that are moving to Washington to avoid paying Oregon's capital gains tax, I don't know that it's measurable, but it is significant. Possibly by getting driver's license exchanges from Oregon to the Vancouver area, greater Vancouver area would help with help put a handle on that. I personally, and I'm here as a board member of AOI also, would oppose carving out a very specific, narrow tax advantage for anybody. I think that is fundamentally wrong. It's part of what's wrong with the federal tax code is that everybody's got their lobbyists back in Washington. Doesn't matter whether you're rich or poor, somehow or other, those guys are going to put in something to benefit you while they go get somebody else. So I would be opposed to the idea of creating a special exemption for people liquidating their business and getting a special tax rate. I would very much support cutting the capital gains rate in half. I think I can only use federal government numbers. They said the talk was we're going to cut capital gains in half and we're going to lose all these billions and billions of dollars. And what happened is it increased significantly the amount of capital gains taxes they received in the federal treasury because people said, okay, I can get rid of this now and only pay 15% on it instead of 38%. And so they would reorder their portfolios or sell their business and do those kind of things. If you're going to tweak the system, I wouldn't. What I would do is create an entirely new system. We've had numerous discussions with Paul on this issue. And that would be cut the income tax rates in half, get rid of all of these gimmicks that are in there, the old people's medical care and all of this kind of stuff, and a dollar here and a dollar there contribution out of your refund. Make it real simple. Three-line tax form. One, what's your federal taxable income? Two, times 4.5%. And that's your Oregon taxes. I would also institute a retail sales tax so that any of the inputs that go into making anything are not taxed. Just whatever, if Intel goes out and buys a box of paper to make notes on, that would be retail. But if they're going out buying a bunch of silicon to make chips with, that would be not subject to this tax. I think you could exclude medical care, housing, probably CPA fees.
But not legal fees.
No, not legal fees. And a few other items that come up with a relative revenue neutral tax system. Corporations would like it. People, human beings that pay taxes would like it. Those people that live in the underground economy and are out buying cars and clothes would not like it. But it would pick them up.
If
I'm going to change the tax system, that's what I would do, and that's AOI has been looking at that for the last several months.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, I have a little bill.
Representative Butler.
A couple of us here.
Mr. Chair, Representative Berger, could we hold off on that until we do our taxes?
Okay.
We'll compare those two numbers.
I just thought I'd point out that I, you know,
yes.
Had a little bill.
There was other questions? Because I have a couple, but I wanted to let other people go first. Mr. Thompson, when you were giving your direct testimony, you talked about how businesses were moving to Washington because of the predictability of the tax system there. And then you went on to say that the tax system here was predictable. And I was having a little trouble understanding. I suspect you were talking about different things, but I wasn't sure.
It is. These are events that have happened 10, 12, 15 years ago.
Yes.
We haven't had anybody decide that it's cheaper or more stable to do business in Washington lately. So that's something that happened while the Oregon system was in a great deal of flux.
We're dealing with old news.
Yes, that was old news.
Okay, thank you. I appreciate that because those two sentences came very close together in your statement, and I couldn't see how they connected. If that helps.
That's probably because I didn't write it down.
All right. The other question I have is related to a little story. Mr. Bezos, who's the head of the, and I may have pronounced his name incorrectly, who is the head of the Amazon book company that now also sells all kinds of other things on the Internet, set up in Seattle at a time when he had no income. In fact, for many years they had no income because they could plow everything back into the business, and in the way in which these things are calculated, he was negative for many years. Managed to make a big stock sale and therefore had cash to spend but no income. And yet he paid very large taxes into the Washington system on the business and occupation tax all through that whole period of time. When he was asked about that, why didn't you set up in a state where they have an income tax instead of a business and occupation tax, the response was, well, Seattle is where I could find the people to do the work, and what I needed to have done was available in Washington. The question that I have, really, and maybe it's for all of you, and it's a question that I think this panel struggles with, and the Representative Witt's committee and other committees struggle with in this building, is how do we get the revenue that we need and plan the budget that we need to plan in order to provide the services so that Mr. Bezos and others will have the people that they need when it comes time for them to set up their businesses, so that the tax system won't matter so much, but what really will matter will be the fact that they can find the raw materials, the transportation, and the people that they need to do the work. And that's the struggle we constantly face as we try to deal with both business taxes and taxes on individuals and other kinds of things. How do we get the revenue to actually make these things work? And of course, my background on that is, and I'm sorry, I'm doing memory here rather than dreaming, but my memory is that we substantially cut our taxes in 1990 with Measure 5. We've never, and measured later with Measure 50, we've never made them back up, and the result is significant when it comes to our educational system and others. So your thoughts on how those two sets of things go together would be useful, I think, for the committee.
Well, Mr. Chair, Jim Craven for the record, I guess in a very short answer, I'd refer back to my testimony. The best way to be able to provide the kind of society we want is to have explicit strategies to grow the kinds of jobs that pay good wages and also the kinds of companies who take care of their employees so their employees are not a burden upon society, and who make profit so they can pay some corporate income tax. But I think absent a wholesale restructuring, and even I believe with any kind of wholesale restructuring, that's the critical prize to keep your eyes on. If you have a declining economy, if you have companies that aren't paying decent wages, that can't afford to pay health care, you could raise the corporate rate from 6.6 to 60.6, and you're probably not going to have the kind of society you want. So I don't think it's that, you know, the focusing on a number or a rate or even the share issue is important as focusing on is our economy going where we want it to go. And I think Governor Kulongoski is fond of saying, you know, a good economy solves a lot of society's ills, and I guess I agree.
Thank you.
Yeah, I would agree with that. I think the Bezos location of Washington was unique to Microsoft and all of those other software writers up there. They don't manufacture stuff. They dream it up in their heads and put it on CDs for us to use. I would agree with what Jim said. A growing economy. If the economy is growing, you guys are going to have more money to spend without changing the tax rates. Look what happened over the last biennium and what's projected into the next biennium. With a growing economy, more and more money comes to Salem. And the more burdensome the taxes become, the less over time that you will receive, because there is not, you know, if my rate goes from 9 to 10%, will I pick up and move? Probably not. If it goes to 15, most of what I do is done on a computer anymore. I rarely see my clients face to face. I go in, I get their information off their computer, I do whatever I do with it, give it back to them with a nice bill, and there's no need for me to see them. So at 15% tax rate, would I relocate to Washington? I would give it very serious consideration.
Thank Mr.
Well, let me just finish my thought, and then...
Okay. I just wanted to say that he's my constituent. I don't want him moving.
Yes, ma'am. I appreciate that very much. And let's go to Representative Witt, too. Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Taking a look at some of the information that I've heard from a CEO from what would perhaps be considered Oregon's traditional economy and a former head of a Fortune 500 company that left Oregon, I had an opportunity to sit with him one evening and, in essence, pick his brains and ask him, why did you leave Oregon? And in short, I think what he told me was this. It's not that the revenue or the taxes were overly burdensome. I think the argument was is that, you know, you could play that game, but the gains that you make by playing that game are not all that substantially great enough to by themselves make the location decision, but rather the quality selection and service of the public services that you buy with those tax dollars. And his concern, I think, as a CEO was, I need a workforce that's adequately prepared to be able to do the job. I need some assistance with product development. I need some assistance with market development. I need to make sure that wherever my business is located, that we have an adequate transportation infrastructure. Those sorts of things. And so I guess my question is, how similar or dissimilar was that conversation with some of the siting considerations that you all see as important?
Mr. Chair, Representative Witt, short answer is I agree with everything you said, and mm-hmm. I hear the exact same thing. I tried to preface that by saying, well, here we are today talking about business taxation, but it is not the only thing people talk about Oregon. In fact, it's not the most important thing. So all those things you mentioned are critical. There is a uniqueness to a billion-dollar capital facility that an area where tax policy does come to the fore as a critical element, more so than in other kinds of decisions. Other kinds of decisions are primarily driven by workforce, access to markets, higher education facilities, and the like. So no disagreement.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Witt.
If that be true, then again, the danger, of course, as Mr. Cravens pointed out earlier, is looking back and reliving history, which may no longer be relevant. But I think there's a lesson to be learned here that we have to, as a state, pay very careful attention to those businesses that are established here, many of whom have provided tax revenue, mm-hmm. have provided jobs, have provided services to our communities, and may either need a helping hand or simply we as a state are in competition with 49 others that are out there doing some very special things, the high performance kind of attractions that are in fact very appealing to many of these companies. And while it may seem overly critical, Mr. Chairman, I think sometimes we have our pride in Oregon sometimes has blinders on it, and there are other states that are doing some very, very good things out there. States like North Carolina, like Georgia, like Arkansas, like Tennessee, that maybe we don't always think are on the cutting edge of attracting and retaining corporations. But they're out there. We are in competition with them. And we would do very well, I think, to pay attention to the good things that they're doing in attracting some very key businesses.
Thank you, Representative Witt. Other questions or thoughts? Gentlemen, thank you very much. We appreciate your presentation and the thoughtfulness with which you approach the subjects and your opinions.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And I think with that, it being a quarter to three and time to move on to our next committee assignments, unless there are announcements, other matters for the committee today, we will adjourn. Thank you.